evening and welcome to the Tuesday, September 21st, 2010, Carborough Board of Aldermen meeting. Before we turn to the items on the agenda, I have two proclamations. So I just would like to read these two proclamations, if you'll indulge me for a moment.
Is there someone from the... Oh, yes, sir. Mr. Madry, would you come up and join me up here, please? This right here is Rob Madry from the Carborough Fire Department. And this proclamation is regarding Fire Prevention Week. Whereas Carborough firefighters responded to 1,589 calls for assistance in 2009, resulting in no fire deaths, only two civilian injuries, and three firefighter injuries. And whereas the fire losses for those calls totaled over $1.1 million in property damage compared to the property valued, the value of the property that that caught fire was in excess of $21 million that was saved by the department. Whereas nationwide, 83% of civilian fire deaths result from residential home fires, unattended cooking being the leading cause of those fires. And whereas residential home fire sprinklers have been proven to save lives and reduce property damage. And whereas being educated on current fire prevention methods by planning ahead, preparing a home fire escape plan, and practicing fire drills has been proven to save lives. And whereas nationally, the month of October is recognized as Fire Prevention Month, with this year's theme being Smoke Alarms, a Sound You Can Live With. And whereas the Carborough Fire Rescue Department is engaged in a proactive effort to reduce the number of fires, deaths, and injuries by conducting fire inspections, delivering fire prevention education, and holding an open house on Saturday, October 2nd, 2010, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. to further that cause. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Mark Chilton, Mayor of the Town of Carborough, North Carolina, do hereby proclaim the week of October 3rd through 9th, 2010 as Fire Prevention Week in the Town of Carborough. And all citizens are encouraged to observe this week of fire prevention by intentionally being fire smart, visiting the fire department to obtain more information, and attending the open house. So I would like to present that to you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
You want to add anything to that?
Mr. Mayor, Alderman, just on behalf of myself, Chief Bradfield, and all the members of the fire department, we'd like to thank you for your support over the last year in helping us in our fire prevention efforts and all that we do. We couldn't do it without your support, and certainly couldn't do it without the fire department staff. And hopefully by reducing these fire losses, we're helping to improve the economy here just a tiny bit. So thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me invite all right. you all personally to come by the open house.
All right.
Is it at that fire station here?
Yes, sir.
Because now we have two.
Yeah. Open house at the fire station, downtown, fire station number one.
Fire station.
Thank you.
It doesn't say headquarters, but it does say the side town hall.
Thank you.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thank
Sparky.
You,
thank you.
Thanks.
If you would join in. joining me up here is Doris Friend, who is the president of the board chair of the board of the Family Violence and Prevention Family Violence Prevention Center in Orange County. Whereas domestic violence is a pattern of coercion and control in an intimate partner relationship where one person uses violence to gain power and control over their partner. And whereas domestic violence includes not only physical but also mental abuse, emotional abuse, financial abuse, isolation, and sexual abuse. And whereas Family Violence Prevention Center of Orange County provided services to 733 victims of domestic violence during last year. And whereas, according to a Commonwealth Fund survey, nearly 31% of American women report being raped and/or physically assaulted by a current or former spouse, partner, or date at some time in their lifetime. And whereas, in North Carolina, according to the statistics of the North Carolina Coalition Against Domestic Violence, there were 70 domestic violence murders between January 1st and December 30th of last year. That's just in North Carolina. 70 murders. And there have been 47 domestic violence murders between January of 2010 and the present date. And whereas, according to the Women's Institute for Leadership Development for Human Rights, high rates of poverty, poor education, limited job resources, language barriers, and fear of deportation increases the difficulty in finding help and support services for minority women. And whereas, prevention strategies involve collaborations by multiple partners and a coordinated community response to promote policies and laws that support gender equity and foster intimate partnerships based on mutual respect, equality, and trust. And whereas the key to prevention is education and requiring accountability by abusers, now therefore be it resolved that I, Mark Chilton, the mayor of the town of Carrboro, North Carolina, do hereby proclaim the month of October 2010 as Domestic Violence Awareness Month in the town of Carrboro, and encourage residents to show support for victims and survivors of domestic violence and to send the message that we are a community working together to end this violence. So, to present that to you, I don't know if you want to add.
Yes, I would. Thank you. To add some very personal and local statistics to these shocking statistics that the mayor just read, I just came from a training for our volunteers. We have a crop of volunteers that go through 48 hours of training, and this evening's training was presented by the Orange County Sheriff's Department. He said that on an average weekend, they respond to 12 to 14 domestic violence calls every weekend, and that since January 1st, he estimated that they'd had 2,200 domestic violence calls. The woman from the crime center, response center that was with him, said that she and her partner, who work on the protective violence, protective orders, served about 1,100 people so far. Only 100 of those people were not related to domestic violence issues. On a very personal level, I got involved with FVPC several years ago when one of my own employees, when I was working at UNC Healthcare, was murdered by her husband out in front of our building, in front of my staff and a lot of people in the building. It was very traumatic for all of us. But on a much happier note, as sobering as those statistics are, and the reality of having domestic violence in our community when we would like to think that it's not, this is our 10th birthday. FVPC is 10 in 2010. And we're having a fundraiser at the top of the hill October 21st to celebrate not domestic violence, but the good work that our staff, our volunteers, and our clients do to get themselves out of this terrible problem. Thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Okay. We will get to our printed agenda momentarily, but before we do, I just wanted to point out one other thing that students from my law alma mater, North Carolina Central University School of Law, are here from the state and local government class this semester at North Carolina Central University, and I understand some of them are in the audience tonight and some of them are watching it at home. But this is part of their coursework to...
Yes.
And their professor is here, you see, to witness it all. So
they get, they actually get academic credit for coming to our meeting.
I think it's some kind of point.
Okay, well, so welcome, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Good luck.
With that, I believe we are on the consent agenda, Mr. Manager.
Item one is the approval of the minutes of the previous meeting of September 7th. Item two is a town code amendment related to road races. Item three is an update on scheduling the continuation of the public hearing on a land use ordinance text amendment related to affordable housing. That's being recommended to be continued until November 23rd. Item four is a town code amendment related to certain bicycle facility improvements made during the 2010 town street resurfacing program and a state bicycle and pedestrian improvement project. Item five is a resolution continuing the public hearing on land use ordinance text amendments related to minimum lot widths, and that recommended date is October 26th.
I have a small correction to the minutes.
All right, let's hear it.
In the minutes on page page 7, when it makes reference to Harrington Bank and OTS, it says Office of Thrift Oversight. And it should be Office of Thrift Supervision. So.
Thank you for catching me.
Move the items as corrected.
Second.
Thank God your supervision caught that oversight.
All right, now.
All right, so we'll take that as a motion and a second for the entire consent agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
Brock, before we move on, I just have a comment on item three from the consent agenda. It's really kind of a question for Steve. I was in communication with this fellow who, if I'm remembering his name correctly, I believe it's Stuart Cowan at the school, and I'm forgetting which school he is. I think he's in the planning school, who worked with Chapel Hill on their analysis that justified their inclusionary housing ordinance. And I think it would be helpful for us when this comes to us in November if planning staff could make a preliminary contact with him so that if the board was inclined to investigate in that direction, you all would have his perspective on what was involved. Because my understanding is that just from the conversations I've had with folks in Chapel Hill and also the email with this fellow, is that that kind of justification is important for this sort of ordinance should we choose to pursue it. So I was thinking I could forward you the email I got from him that kind of talked about this, and you can kind of follow up
Trish,
on that.
Do you all know him?
You okay. Do? Okay.
Okay.
So you're good with that?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. I believe that brings us to a public hearing on extension of time to issue bonds for sidewalks and greenway trails. Mr. Manager.
This is to hold a public hearing on whether the maximum time period for issuing bonds for the construction of sidewalks and greenways should be extended from 7 years to 10 years, and then to consider the adoption of an appropriate order to approve the extension. And George Sizer, Public Works Director, is making his way up to the podium before we begin the public hearing to provide you with an update on the status of our project today. George.
No offense, George, but I think for once we'll hear your presentation.
No offense taken.
Let me also mention that Bob Jessup, our bond counsel, is here if the board has any technical questions about the extension.
Good evening, everybody. The purpose of tonight is to give a brief update, and I want to let you know the recent progress we've made on our projects, as well as talk a little bit about the timeline for the remaining projects. And I know you've seen some of these maps before, but this was our phase 1A sidewalk bond projects. There were 10 projects with this. Phase 1B, and this included the enhancement projects, and there are now 9 projects on this map, including most recently Ash Street and then Bim Street right outside here of Town Hall. This is a table you've seen before, which lists the in feet and miles of the progress of the projects that are completed. Again, we're up to 19 projects, roughly 4 miles worth of new sidewalk, 7 contracts totaling over $2.2 million in construction. And I want to point out that during this roughly 5 years, this isn't all that Public Works has done. There's been 3 paving projects. We built the Roberson bike path, a new generator at the Century Center, 2 roof replacements, and 3 bus shelters as well. We have about 2.5 miles yet to do of the remaining Phase 1 projects. That's 5 projects. And of that 2.5 miles, Roger Road is one of those projects, which is a mile of that 2.5 miles. I have some before and after photos here. This is Ash Street looking north, and this was just after some gas main work prior to the construction of the sidewalks. So we'll progress north here. Let me know if this is too exciting for everybody here. And then here are some after photos, starting in the same direction. And we were able to tie in our resurfacing program with both Ash and Bim Street. This is an integral sidewalk, and of course it has a new storm sewer system instead of the water going to the ditch. And here is Bim Street, also going north. 2 before photos, and then here's after.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. It's nice to see people using this, especially this walk right here by mm-hmm. Town Hall, mm-hmm. which was rather hazardous with the ditch next to it and so forth before. So they have turned out quite nicely. I also included Old Fayetteville Road, which is currently under construction, which is an NCDOT project. And this is about 2,000 feet on the east side of Old Fayetteville Road, and roughly extends from the existing walk that was at the school, edge of the school property. Comes down now to 54, and as part of the project, there are crosswalk signals being put in for folks to get across 54. There's a safe refuge island, if you will, as you come across. And then some new sidewalk was put in by the credit union as well. So it's all connected now. I believe this is at Carroll Street. Mm-hmm. This is a timeline similar to ones that you've seen before. And let me quick go through the color scheme here. This looks a lot different than it did in my computer. But anyway, the yellow is design, and the bid award is actually green, but it's almost the same color. And then construction is blue. The down here to your lower left, the we'll call that salmon color is the consultant selection. And I'll go through some of these things. I broke this down into paving, sidewalks, and greenways. I've included the paving section at the top, even though that's not part of the bond project, but to give you a better frame for the staffing in the coming year here that's going to be needed. Weaver Street, the plans are just about finished, and we're getting permits, and Ted is feverishly working on getting easements so that we can put this project out for bid in the beginning of November. Construction will take just about a year. And then below that is we're in the midst of our resurfacing contract, roughly $500,000 worth of resurfacing. And then coming down to sidewalks, Bim and Ash are completed. This was a stimulus fund project, ARRA, and we're in the process, Ted is in the process of getting reimbursement. And then we come down to Elm Street is the next project. And this is funded by sidewalk bond funds and safe routes to school funds, and design has already started on that. And then I should point out, after I lost the, here we go, that construction is slated for Elm Street in 2011. Let me point out the timeline up here. These are in fiscal years from this point to this point. So you get a sense for So we're working on design and then construction in 2011. And then as we finish up design on Elm Street, we'll jump into these remaining four projects here. And I want to point out, maybe you're aware that Estes, there is a continuation of the public hearing in regards to the alternates, I believe, next week. That is on the agenda, so that still needs to be decided. And then I've also shown Rogers Road. And this is a different line because it has STPDA funds in it. We still need to get a municipal agreement, but the design and so forth will take about the same amount of time. And then construction is planned for 2012 for these remaining projects. And then we get to the greenways, and down here to the lower left, the Wilson path, which is phase 1A of the Bowling Creek Greenway. RFQ was released in July of this year. 10 firms submitted letters. Kinley Horn was selected to do the design work, and town staff is currently negotiating a contract for that. I believe the scoping meeting has already been held. And another aspect of this project, we just recently found out, and it was, I believe, in the board manager memo about the town receiving a Diener grant for additional funding for this project in the order of about $75,000. There is a 25% match, but hats off to Anita and her staff, and specifically Brendan Moore, and I'm sure Jeff was involved in it, in obtaining these funds. So design will begin shortly on that. Then we get to Bolin, and we're awaiting a draft supplemental agreement from NCDOT on Phase 1B. And staff is communicating with UNC and other stakeholders on the alignment. And then you see the design. We'll have to do the municipal agreement, then consultant selection, and then design for the project estimated at this point, and then construction also out in 2012. Now, I have to point out that for these two, since we really don't have much in the way of design yet, the amount of time needed for construction is still kind of up in the air. And then we get down to Morgan at the very bottom.
George, before you depart, Bolin, I'm sorry. So were you, that line that says Wilson at the left represents phase 1A. 1A, which is basically from Wilson Park down to Estes Drive extension.
Yes.
Just so the public's clear about what we're talking about. And then the line that says Bolin, that represents what exactly? That's phase 2?
Phase 1B and 2.
1B and 2, which are from Homestead Road to Sewell Elementary School, I believe.
Jolly Branch.
Yeah. I can have Jeff, I've got a map here, but it's
and then also a connection that's north of Homestead Road. I guess the point
Lake
being
Hogan
that
Farms,
none of that has to do with that area that's been that some people are so eager to have a debate about.
Right.
Yeah, just point out that there's, of course, you all know, no final plans, and there is no identified funding for those future phases.
Right.
That I was just mentioning. Exactly. I just wanted
George, I just wanted to ask on the Bolin 1B, which is the Homestead to Jolly Branch, was Claremont going to be partnering with us with that at all?
I'll have to defer to Jeff and or Trish.
Okay.
Or Trish stood up quickly.
The Bolin that's on this spreadsheet is phase 1B, and it does connect from Claremont to basically near Jolly Branch, and so that's the alignment conversation we're having with University and others to figure out that connection across Bolin and back the creek up to the school complex essentially. It does not include the Jones Creek Greenway, which is phase 2 in the plan. And yes, there is
so
a.
It does not include.
It does not include that.
It's 1B only.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That's why I'm asking.
Well, Jones Creek is near Lake Hogan Farms.
Right, that's phase two.
Jones Creek is a project that's noted in the CIP, but we haven't identified any match for funds that we've. Some of the funds have been identified through STPDA, but not all of them, mm-hmm. and we don't have any match yet identified either.
So that's just a little bit further out.
That's a little bit further out, and we are working with the folks from Claremont, okay. The developers, both on. One of the conditions on the Claremont phases 4 and 5, the second part of the project, did include making a payment for a piece of the greenway mm-hmm. that they were planning but are not constructing, which it's not really in our plan to build it on the west side or the sort of north side of the creek at that point. And that those funds can be put towards
okay.
this project as well as perhaps some others for the piece they have not constructed above Homestead Road. But this will connect underneath Homestead Road and over to the school complex. That's what this bowling is.
Thank you.
That's great. Thanks.
And George, just a point of clarification, too, about the Rogers Road sidewalk. I think we've talked about this in the past. Does it begin at Meadow Run, right, and then run toward Homestead?
That's correct, yes. Okay. Yeah, it would be roughly from Rogers Road all the way out on the west side.
We'll go all the way to Homestead?
Yes. Yes. I mean, nothing's been finally decided yet, but the preliminary estimate includes with that entire distance.
Okay.
For the Estes section, there's a couple of different options being considered. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's the follow-up with the continuation of the public hearing next week.
All right.
That's basically all I have.
Okay. I don't have anybody signed up, I don't think, but is there anyone who would like to speak on this matter at the public hearing? Okay. If not, I would like to speak at the public hearing, just briefly.
Last time you did.
No, really briefly. As long as I don't get out of my seat.
Okay. Hit the timer.
You're not going to give us a history.
No, definitely not. No, but I was just going to say that I think this entire project has represented a huge commitment that mostly our predecessor board of aldermen and mayor, few of our current aldermen are from that board, decisions that they made, I think, about 7 years ago to really commit to making Carrboro more pedestrian-oriented community. And I think those of us who joined the board since have been committed to seeing that through and pushing that forward and making that happen. And I'm really proud of the results that we've achieved so far. And as you can see, we still have within our plans and in our immediate sites some major additional pedestrian and bicycle improvements. And I think that's what our town is all about, and so I just would urge that we request an extension of time.
Let me make one brief follow-up comment, which is that at our transit partners meeting tonight, we got a report, the preliminary report on the transit survey that the transit system does, and one of the questions they asked people in Chapel Hill and Carrboro was how many vehicles they have. And Lydia, if you remember the exact numbers, you can help me, but Carrboro had nearly twice the number of households with one or zero cars as Chapel Hill does. And I think that's reflective of the voters who approved these bonds and, you know, the commitment of the town to building these sidewalks and the commitment of everyone in the town to being involved in alternative transportation. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was worth bringing in there. Is that about right?
Yeah, there? Something.
Yeah. Well, I'll move attachment A.
Second.
All right, attachment A has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Anything else we need to do on that, Councillor? All right.
Just a reminder that this is the only extension that we get, so we got to get all of this done in the next 3 years.
By the way, Bob, one of the most outstanding bond council presentations I've ever seen. Thank you. With that, we are on item E1, review of affordable housing for the Verde redevelopment conditional use permit project. Before we begin the agenda item proper, Alderman, you may recall I have a conflict of interest because I have some involvement in this project, so or potential future involvement in the project, so I would ask that you recuse me from being involved in this discussion.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded that I be recused. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passes unanimously. Thank you.
Is there a staff presentation?
There is no staff report. This is a direct request from the applicant to talk with you all about some changes in conditions from when they met with you all back in 2008. So it'd be appropriate to recognize the applicant.
Okay.
What action will we be being asked to take on this, if any?
I believe whether or not you all would consider the requested changes in their approach to addressing the affordable housing.
Would receive a copy of the correspondence. That
yes.
Would you introduce yourself before you start?
Yeah, go I'm ahead. Tripp Overholt, one of the principals.
And my name is David Bell. I'm partner in the project.
So it's been a while. We were here in front of you guys in December of 2008 to talk about the affordability provision that is part of the review process. We requested that the affordability provision be waived in our case, and Marty Rupert reviewed the video on the meeting earlier today, and he thought it would be a good idea if I went back and shared with you just what was talked about at that meeting to put things in context. So it was our contention that the affordable provision couldn't be fairly applied to the Verdia redevelopment project because the density portion of the provision could not be applied to our situation because we were set on our density by the ordinance, and also our homes are size restricted. And so given those realities, the very small size of the homes, we contend that it's a market-driven affordability that we think is ideal and the kind of affordability that we'd like to see other developers do, build smaller houses at lower prices than are traditionally built in town. So at the time, that was early in our process, and we're not really backing off of anything that we said at that meeting, but we want to bring up some points. At that time, we were asked, well, what did we think we could build these 1,350-square-foot houses for and sell them for? And we suggested $289,000 was what we had in our budget at the time. At the time, we did not have any bids in from any builders, so it was an estimate. And there was some discussion after that point was made, primarily between Jackie and Dan, where it was desired that we get pinned down a little bit more precisely, and there was a concern that we not just be able to jack the prices to any level that we might want. And so a verbal agreement was settled on where $300,000 was considered the upper limit of the houses, and we thought that was a reasonable proposition. So that's where we were at in 2008. So now in September of 2010, and we've learned a few things, and we want to make you aware of these things. One is that we did get our costs back from our builder and from a company that we would hire to do the horizontal work on the site. The builder's cost was $6 a square foot more than our budget. Also, the horizontal work, which is all the infrastructure that's necessary on the site, came in at about $200,000 higher than budgeted, mainly because of increased costs in ductal pipe, which have gone through the roof for the sewer, and also for asphalt. Also, at the time, we weren't really settled on all of the features that we'd be offering standard or which would be considered upgrades to buyers, and we decided that we thought it would be a good idea if we made some things standard that were being considered optional. They include solar hot water systems on every house at a cost of between $4,000 and $5,000 a house, carports so that each family could have one vehicle garaged at a cost of $4,000 to us, and then sprinkler system in every house at an estimated cost of $2,000. So there's $10,000 to $11,000 of features that we're going to be upsold to the buyers that are now included in the cost of the homes. The other issue is that the economy has imploded since we started our adventure here, and we don't know how long it may take for us to actually build the community. We're hoping we can start next year, but to do so will be, well, we don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Excuse me. Wasn't December 2nd, 2008 kind of after the economy was already imploding? Or had it just not caught up with you at that point? I'm just wanting to clarify that point.
I think it had started by then.
It had started, but the fact, for example, that even this community would be as affected as it is, I don't think it really registered with anyone yet.
Maybe not you.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Go on.
So we think that a good way to handle the fact that we don't know when we're going to be able to build the community, the increased costs that we have, and the things that we're now including as standard features in our homes would be to allow us a cost of consumer price index increase so that when we eventually do build the houses, we can at least cover some of those costs that we're talking about. Now, there's just one more thing I want to add before we get to the questions that you might have, and it's this. We aren't making any additional money on the difference between the $289,000 that we talked about before and the $310,000 we might like to charge for our homes if you granted our request. All of that additional money for the homes is cost that's embedded, a significant portion of it is embedded in features that we're providing in this community that make it a model of green development that no one has ever attempted. So we're including a 100-kilowatt solar power system, isonine foam insulation, a LEED-certified neighborhood, green-certified homes, solar hot water, a whole bunch of stuff. A native landscaping scheme that's going to be fully developed, many thousands of dollars of amenities that are not included in houses that are being sold for the same or more money than we're talking about selling our houses that are like 6 and 8 years older than the houses that we're going to be building. So we're bringing a very affordable product to market, and the long-term cost. We think that the most important issue is the long-term cost to the environment and to the buyers of the homes. And by including these extra $20,000 worth of amenities, the long-term cost to homeowners will be lower and the cost to the environment will be lower than if we don't include these amenities. But if we wanted to be stuck on price, we could get rid of some of these amenities and we could charge $289,000 for the houses and still be in the same place where we are right now.
Yeah, we can. What is there now is some of the nicest affordable housing in the community. It will be replaced by housing that is not affordable to the people who currently live in it. 300,000 and up is not affordable housing. Some cost of both labor and materials have gone down in the past couple years. I know framing materials have gone down. Metal roofing has gone down. Many subcontractors have gone down. I would feel very uncomfortable removing some of the last good stock of moderate
and affordable housing, and saying that you don't have to add to that stock. I feel very uncomfortable doing that, and I will not support that. Other builders are also looking to make money. Other builders are also moving in an environmental direction because that's what the market's demanding, and they have to follow the affordable housing rules. You're asking to go up in the size. You're also saying that, that you want to add these kind of high-end amenities, off of which I'm sure you'll make a percentage. There's nothing wrong with making a profit, but I cannot comfortably say, sure, it's fine to remove what we have now and not add to the affordable housing stock. And this is not affordable, so I cannot support this.
That's fine. When we came in here and polled the board in December of 2008, we asked straight up whether or not that's a fine opinion, but we asked the board in total whether or not they would support our contention that bringing in the lowest priced new housing in this town and the greenest at the same time was going to be something that you were interested in. And the general consensus of the board was yes. Had it not been yes, wouldn't have undertaken this two-year effort and the considerable amount of money that we're spending to create this model of green development.
It's fine to pursue this project. It's an admirable project, but when it comes to providing affordable housing, that's a core value of this community, and I think that every development, particularly now with the changes you've proposed, needs to stick by that.
But the way that the affordable housing provision is able to work right now is that builders build expensive homes at $500,000 plus, which offsets the loss of about $130,000 per home represented by the affordable housing. When you're not building $500,000 to $750,000 homes and all of your homes are at $300,000, you cannot afford to build 15% of the homes at a loss of $120,000 a house.
I'm not going to stand here and I'm firmly committed to having our affordable housing stock. And this project will diminish the affordable housing project, and what you're now proposing, it would be without adding anything to it. And I can't support that.
Trip, I have some questions for you. The list in the third paragraph of your, what for us is attachment E, you have a list of sustainability features, and those are all, those are the ones you described to us 2 years ago, and those are all continuing. Those are not at all in risk in terms of what you're proposing here. Is that correct?
Well, the issue is essentially, initially the analysis was that the northern row of homes would have solar hot water on them because we weren't sure of the exposure along the southern end of the site. And the idea would be that the people on the northern row obviously would pay some additional money to have solar hot water on their home. We did determine ultimately that it would be feasible to put solar hot water on the southern row as well. And we really desire that, particularly since we are trying to brand and market this community as a solar community and to be a model for sustainable development in the future, to have every home as a standard feature to have solar thermal.
Okay, so that's an addition.
That is an addition. The other things, there were a number of features that were questionable as to whether or not they would be an additional charge, particularly the carports. Initially, there were not intended to be enough carports to have one for every unit. So again, it was going to be an additional charge in order to make it equitable for everyone living in the community. You would essentially have the option to purchase a carport. We assumed that potentially there would be residents that might not want a carport. We ultimately determined that in order to meet parking requirements and also in order to just make the community a bit more livable and desirable, that it would be necessary to have 39 carport units. And at that point, we decided it would make a lot of sense to try to offer that as a standard feature. I believe it also might be necessary in terms of closing in on the parking requirement required for the town for in terms of number of parking spaces required for a residential community.
Okay. I have two other points. Yeah. One thing I just want to be very clear on, at the beginning of that paragraph, you say that assuming a rigid interpretation of the agreement 2008, blah, 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 mm-hmm. that it might mean removing the green features. So I don't know what you may or may not think you heard on the tape, but I am absolutely certain that my support for this in 2008 was with the understanding that the price we were agreeing to included these green features that would lower the cost of living in those homes to the residents. Mm-hmm. So the agreement of 2008 does not give you the option of removing those green features. So you're mistaken in making that suggestion. That's just not an option. That's what you presented to us, and that's what we agreed to. The house is up to $300,000 with the green features you described. And I do appreciate your adding the additional solar hot water. I think that's a great improvement.
We didn't even know about the carports and the sprinkler systems in 2008.
Okay. I don't know whether or not those are green features, but that's neither here nor there. I support the way you lay out, the way the costs have gone up. I'm not an expert in the construction field like Jackie is, but it certainly makes sense to me that in 2 years, costs could have gone from 300 to 311 as a cap, and that's not a huge difference. What is that, about 3%? Am I figuring that right? My concern really is the upgrades, and I don't know that I can support the upgrades you're proposing because, basically you're not really selling them for $311 at that point. You're selling them for some unspecified amount higher than that, and certainly any homeowner is free to do whatever upgrades they want to do to their home. I've done upgrades to my home, and that's my business as a homeowner. But in terms of when we're talking about the cost here, you're not laying out for us any particulars of what you're thinking about with those upgrades, but certainly we're talking about some thousands or perhaps even tens of thousands of potential upgrades in terms of finishes and appliances or whatever those might be. That I think that aspect of it moves me from the position of Tripp agreeing with your response to Jackie in terms of where the pricing of this is to agreeing with Jackie. If you see what I'm saying, that I agree with you that if you're building housing for 300 or 311 in a climate where everyone else is building housing for 500 to 300 quarters of a million, that's a very valuable contribution given everything you're putting into this project. But if you're going beyond that as you're proposing to do here, I think that's too much. And so to gain my support, you're going to need to rethink that aspect of it in some respect.
Well, the upgrade aspect is really just a sensible thing that you don't. If somebody's going to want to have a more environmentally progressive thing in their house or something different than what's standard, you usually wouldn't put it in just to rip it out.
I
don't know. I have no idea what you just said.
Well, let's say we put a standard. Yeah, go ahead.
The implementation would essentially be that, we would put X into the building as part of our base model, but the person is potentially purchasing a house before it's even built and doesn't want that and wants something else in its place. It would be extremely inefficient for us to put something that they don't want in. Potentially, we wouldn't even get the buyer at that point if we have to put in a certain flooring type that they really don't want. For example, recycled carpeting is probably what we're going to be using on the upper levels. A lot of people really hate carpeting.
Telling us in this respect is that the project you brought us 2 years ago, what you're saying later in this paragraph is that that's not marketable. It's not marketable.
No, it is marketable to a definite section of the market.
Okay, and are there, how many homes are there here, 39?
39 homes.
So are there potentially 39 sales in that section of the market?
I think that there are. The question would just be whether or not if somebody affluent enough wanted to live in the community due to its green profile or location as opposed to the size and finish level of the homes, would be dissuaded from purchasing due to the finish level, the interior finish level.
What we're concerned with in this discussion is not what the affluent want. The affluent have lots of choices in Carrboro and will continue to have more choices and hopefully more and better green choices as well. We're concerned with a project that was presented to us as affordable. You've heard from one board member who considers it beyond the pale as it is, and I guess I didn't watch the tape, but presumably Jackie felt that way 2 years ago as well. I'm willing to support it as originally presented to us and as here without the upgrades, if you want to look at it that way. And it's not a point of contention or for you to explain to me. It's kind of like how far I think we can go with the price point for Tripp's comment that this is an important market segment that's not being served with new housing and that we need in Carrboro, and we especially need it with this kind of green feature. So,
okay. Also, to put it somewhat in perspective, the complete upper end, if you subbed in every upgrade that we're really intending on putting in, would probably be roughly $10,000 to $12,000 more. Because you would be subtracting the cost of whatever, you know, item was going to go in there, and then just adding the incremental increase of whatever the customer would prefer. And they are all going to be, or would potentially be, you know, very green options. They would be either, you know, super high efficiency appliances, which are unfortunately more expensive. They would be, you know, bamboo flooring and, you know, items like that, paper stone countertops as opposed to formica and you know, things of that nature. So it's not really a game changer in terms of the price. It's mostly about the economic reality that we face in trying to market and sell the community, which we are, you know, I have to admit, somewhat concerned about. And we do very much want to deliver a community that's going to be, you know, a model for green development and is going to be accessible to as much of the population as it can be, given the, you know, fixed costs that exist for building in Carrboro, you know, and all of the process and, you know, construction that has to be undergone as part of that.
Can I just comment? I mean, I think what your point is very, you know, logical and probably something that should be considered from the town scale to facilitate that kind of, you know, smart way of understanding that people move in, they may rip out, and that's a waste for the landfill. And I think we should really think about an ordinance that could be sensitive to that. So, for example, not a requirement for giving the permit to allow people to move in or something intermediary so that they could really, you know, put in what they'd actually like. But I think that there are a couple of things about this project, and I wasn't here when the original agreement was done, but when I first heard about it, and I agree with Jackie, it's pretty problematic in as much as this town does not have so much affordable housing, and the footprint of where this project is going to be is going to replace some of the few affordable housing that we have. I don't know why it is that a lot of the green projects that happen tend to have these conflicts that have, you know, social justice issues. So like Greenbridge was a perfect example for the community, just sheerly for where it was located. So I think that it's especially with this project, and unfortunately because you all are doing a lot of very positive green futures with it, unfortunately because we don't have any way to offset it in any other way throughout the community to assure that there is affordable housing somewhere else, it is a burden for y'all to really present a case that would make this to appear more affordable. And even $300,000, which was the original agreement, from my perspective, is way out of bounds for what is considered affordable. So, and I've got friends who have moved to Durham, Hillsborough, Pittsburgh, because they can't live in this town. So, and I have friends who actually lived in that trailer park before they moved. So it's problematic to me. The other question I had related to you described that the prices for increase in pipe and asphalt, those are increased costs. It would be interesting to see how those have been counterbalanced with some of the price drops that Jackie was describing, and see if perhaps that actually balances out or not. And then I was also struck, and maybe I misunderstood, did you all get quote only from one builder, or do you have more quotes?
Well, yeah, we did get quotes from multiple builders initially. The only quote that came back that was even in the ballpark of what we could, make happen was from Cimarron Homes, and that's predominantly because they actually specialize in building lower cost green housing. You really don't find low cost green housing. I mean, typically green homes are the mega expensive homes that have everything in the book thrown at them.
Right.
And then they just pass all that plus a significant margin on to the homeowner, which is not a workable model for us. Our goal is to try to drive the price down as much as possible while keeping the real essence of what makes a home sustainable intact and in the home itself.
I've got an anecdote to kind of illustrate the idea of sustainability as it differs between people of low income and high income. I was at a workshop that was showing how to do weatherization and energy audits, and the people whose house this was being done at had all these issues, as was demonstrated through the audit, and they had like the equivalent of a Windows hole in their home. And at the point when the person who was doing the audit was showing the price difference between the bills that the people whose house this was being done and the person who was doing the audit, who had all the bells and whistles of green, it was noticeable that the person who was doing this audit's bill was at least three times more expensive than the people who lived in a really, un-PC green building. The difference being in their lifestyle and the fact that they didn't turn their AC on because it didn't work. And this is the issue we have, where people who have no means are actually greener. And what we end up doing by only focusing on the green technology is displacing the most green people simply because they can't afford. So we really have a task at hand to figure out how to make it encourage the most green people, who unfortunately are the least means, to continue to be within our community.
I remember 2 years ago when you came before us with this proposal, and I supported it then, as did the board. And in particular, and I kind of wish Joel was here too, because I do remember, she's sick tonight, I understand. But I remember our board, as well as the planning board, to which I'm liaison, talking at length about the concern about the affordable housing and the loss of affordable housing, and kind of wrapping their head around this idea that it was such a neat development with the green features, and it's affordable at $290, and that's why, like the others, something about jumping up even to 300, 300 and something, and then saying 10 or 15 more for the amenities, it takes it to a level beyond which I was contemplating with the development. And it's part of the reason it was so appealing and still is so appealing in its current form was it's just kind of a different animal in that form. I think to upgrade it or to cross that threshold into 300 and above just takes it a little bit out of that for me. So
I was just going to chime in and say, I'm quoted here from 2008, stating that we should look at the affordability and how it relates to energy efficiency and the use of the land. And I think it's, I'm very concerned about the 15% that trading out that 15% of affordable housing and supplanting it with housing that I don't see as being in the affordable range. And
And, you know, Jackie mentioned affordable housing stock. We're very concerned about having that at least stable in Carrboro. To take a step back during this economy would be unwise, despite the, you know, and that, aside from that, there would be people who would be displaced, you know, so I personally would be hard-pressed. I liked the idea of the original model. I realize that the green issue is expensive, and it may be that, you know, I hate to see that, I agree with Sammy, that green be something that only if you're affluent enough you can reach a green standard. Something is not right with that mindset. So, you know, I'd like to look at the old model,
which is what
that was more comfortable.
If I may, just really quickly touch on 2 points. The first is primarily the issue. We're very aware of the issue surrounding social justice and the issue with replacing the trailer park. Having been very involved with the trailer park over the past year and a half, there's an essential economic reality which I do think needs to be realized and taken into account in any conversations surrounding it, which is that the park cash flows negatively, which means that if there weren't a redevelopment potential and work being made towards that end, it would be shut down right now. It has been, you know, we've put in a significant amount of money to keep it going at a huge loss over the past couple of years in order to try to move forward towards this project that we're attempting to endeavor that we, you know, kind of hope was sort of we really are trying to essentially give the town what they want and what you're looking for. I do think it's very important to realize that it really is not a choice between the trailer park and the development. It's a choice between, you know, basically an abandoned lot or, you know, it's a bankruptcy, you know, and having to really do a major transition and some redevelopment option or, you know, the equivalent. That's just, you know, I'm not sure. That's just the reality that is kind of.
No, I want to refine that. The ordinance gives us permission to redevelop the trailer park. And if I didn't care about the environment and if I was profit and greed oriented, back in 2007, what I would have done is removed the trailer park and put the most inexpensive housing possible in there. And it would not have been a green development. It would not have been a nice development. And that's the reality that would have happened. But we're laboring mightily to produce a model of green development. And the only reason that we're asking you to consider allowing us to add a tiny amount of additional cost to the houses is so that we can long-term produce the most cost-effective green product anywhere in the state of North Carolina or anywhere in the country at this price point. I mean, there's never going to be another community built in this town at this price point. We're doing amazing to bring it in at this price point. We're way down below the average cost of new developments. And as far as the social justice issue of the trailer park goes, I have to tell you that it's an extremely transient community. They self-relocate on the average of every 18 months. I went down a hierarchy of social responsibility outcomes for that trailer park where I envisioned every possible thing that I could do to empower the owners of the people that lived in that trailer park. First thing I wanted to do was make them owners of their own trailers. That wasn't going to be possible because half of the population isn't even native born, aren't even citizens, I'm presuming, and then the other half don't have the credit ratings to even afford a $50,000. I would have sold them their trailers for $50,000 a piece, and they could have paid the same amount of money to own their trailer as they were paying in rent. Okay, that was a no-go. I've gone through every possible scenario to keep that trailer park and not redevelop it. But the bottom line is that's not possible. So we wanted to do it right. And the additional cost of the homes above the bottom line cost of what a house costs to build in this town is not that great. And you have an opportunity to approve the greenest model development that's ever been attempted in this state. So that's all I'm
But what of the 15% affordable housing. I mean, so that's lost.
If I may.
But let me ask you, how would you apply that provision? You can't. I mean, the way the code is written doesn't work in our situation.
It is true. I mean, the essential issue is that we have no way out of the two ways that you can kind of benefit from the provision, namely having increased density and then being able to garner a significant amount of profit on significantly higher square footage homes. That's kind of the bone, you know.
You'll be garnering, the way I see it, frankly, is that you're going to be able to market this. Small homes are becoming more and more the in thing. You're going to be able to market very, very environmentally responsible, but also very tricked out small homes next to an incredible school and within walking distance of our downtown. You will be able, I am sure, that the affluent market will quickly become your target because people will want it. People are willing to, once they're empty nesters or single people, to live in smaller homes. You all know this. That's where the designs are going. It's how the space is laid out and how it's tricked out. So you will have a very high-end market. And I think it's incumbent on you to provide, you will have houses you're making more money on. And there's no way I will believe that you won't, and that affluent people won't want to live there. I think you're capable of providing the 15% affordable housing, and I think you need to come back with the way of doing it.
I want to hear from Trish or Mike about the question they just raised about their interpretation of the affordability ordinance. That I mean, if we had the situation before where a developer has not been able to benefit from it, I think we had, it was Claremont recently, where they had no or minimal bonus units. Is that correct? Or Marty could speak to it.
Yes, if that's okay.
Thanks, Marty.
It is true that some more typical developments don't take advantage of the density bonus that the ordinance provides, and still are able to build their product or their project with 15% affordable built in. They do presumably, I don't know exactly how much every house is selling for, but they do presumably sell their market rate houses for a cost, you know, in the range we've been talking about earlier tonight, 500 and up typically. So they're receiving that additional profit even though they aren't taking advantage of the market rate affordable units that they could build. It's a kind of a choice that some developers make just based on the amount of land and the size of the lots that they want to offer people. So I think it, on the one hand, is fair to recognize that some developers do projects without taking full advantage of the density bonus, but I'd also recognize that what they're saying is accurate, that the way the density is set up for this project via a court case from a long time ago, they have a set number of units they can do on this site, and that's been settled by the court system a long time ago. So this project, I think it is fair to say it's difficult to even offer them those extra units.
Let me ask you also, my understanding was, well, I guess they're making some access changes, which will require a CUP, and that's what brings it under the affordable housing requirement in the first place. Is that right? Or?
And they want the units large.
Right.
Well, that's what brings it under the conditional use permit process. Okay. So,
but even without a CUP, we still do the affordable housing review typically? I don't recall that. I'm just
no, that's the affordable housing review is in front of you because of the CUP being required. So it's I guess I would make the point just for clarity that the ordinance doesn't require 15% affordable housing. It's, you know, an expectation that most developers do adhere to. They are required to get the CUP based on some changes to the site, and therefore we're here discussing affordable housing. there are changes being made, and I don't know if Tripp wants to speak to this in any level of detail, but there are changes being made to the site plan as we speak, or perhaps have already been made. So I just point that out for with respect to what's in your package. Since we're in a quasi-judicial setting with respect to the CUP, we were only able to provide the concept plan from back in 2008. We didn't want to show anything newer, as it were.
And if they do this proposed rezoning, does that reopen this whole process?
Then? Yes, it would. Yes, that would be, well, the
and any, all our discussion tonight becomes sort of moot at that point that we are in that.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say it becomes moot. It just kind of reinforces the fact that there's a CUP attached to the rezoning, and therefore the affordable housing review is pertinent and applicable here.
What I don't know if it's Tripp or David would answer this, but what changes are contemplated that result in having a couple of smaller houses and a couple of larger houses? I guess the way the road's coming in or something? Or?
It would be part of the rezoning. It's one of the requirements is that you have a certain number of these smaller units, 1,100 square feet, and but it does open up, I think it actually requires a certain number of at least 1350. Almost all of our units are 1350, but then opens up the possibility of having larger units at up to I think 1600, which was I guess we just came up with that because it's the same amount over 1350 as 1100 is under, so that the average would.
And do you contemplate that the average price between an 1100 and a 1600
right,
would be 311?
The proposal would be that however much less than the base the 1100s are would be the same amount over it that the 1600s would be, and in that way the averages out.
We have serious concerns about whether or not this community can happen, and one reason we have to maximize our chances of success, and by going for the rezoning and putting the houses on lots, it changes the financial markets for the mortgages. If we don't do that, it'll be a condo market financing situation, and the condo financing markets have been pounded in the recession because there have been a lot of failures in the condo markets, and there's just a much wider range of financing available to people that would like to buy our homes if they're on their own lots. So that's why we're going for the refinancing, to give us a better chance of success. The other thing is, one of the big objections many people have, very few people can wrap their heads around moving from their 2,400 square foot average home into a 1,350 square foot home. That's considered a really small home by most people. And so to help us succeed, again, we don't really care about 1,600 versus 1,300 or 1,100, but there are a lot of people out there who just can't get themselves into a 1,300 square foot house. So in order to increase our chances of success by having a few of those larger houses, we can sell to a few more people that otherwise would say no.
Would these, I'm sorry, you still?
Okay, I guess, I'm one of those people. We fill our 1,600 something square feet. It would be hard to go smaller. But anyway, I guess my feeling about this is that I sit here month after month, year after year, and under the requirements of the ordinance, approve a lot of projects that I don't feel real great about. I don't feel like they further our goals for Carrboro. I think, builders are making homes that the affluent people who move into them are quite happy in and enjoy being part of the community. But in terms of the goals of this board, the range of goals of Vision 2020, we're not really achieving that. And this is, frankly, a pretty unique case of a developer who's wanting to do something exceptional at a reasonable price on a constrained property. And I may have made this exact same comment 2 years ago, but I mean, that's why I supported it then, and that's why I continue to support this. I mean, I don't want to see this project go back to the proposal that would just tear out the trailers and put in 39, kit houses or something that have that offer nothing and would have no affordability either, because there's no requirement to. I mean, I think this project is good for Carrboro. You know, my neighborhood, which I enjoy living in, is in this price range, actually a little lower. But we don't have any of this stuff. You know, we have nothing like that. You know, Randy, you're struggling to figure out how to build a solar array for a few homes to share. I couldn't get solar hot water because of the trees. But anyway, I digress. But, I continue to applaud what you guys are trying to do. And I do hope that we can come to some point of agreement where, you know, the town can support you in that. I don't know if we'll get there from what I've heard from my colleagues, but I would like to see this project happen.
You go, Sammy, then. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with Dan. This is a great project, and I'm feel, you know, like I owe y'all an apology for the fact that we're not set up as a town to accommodate these kinds of projects as much as we should be. But this is a unique property itself, too, and so that's unique in and of itself. And I was just wondering, you were saying, you know, part of the issue being that you're not allowed to have the large enough houses on this property that would allow for the kind of financing that you could do the 15% affordable housing. Would the current request for, you know, larger houses and then decreasing other houses facilitate or get you closer to being able to finance?
Well, this is one thing I was going to mention. I mean, we'd be more than happy if, I don't know what latitude there is for any kind of middle ground, but for example, putting particularly the smaller units that are already going to be significantly cheaper, I don't know, $30,000 or more cheaper than the standard aside, and at least having somebody who, I don't know, it's not going to be down at, like, you know, the artificially subsidized level, but it'll be cheaper, and we'd be more than happy to try to make sure that folks who are, you know, close to the level of, you know, that being kind of at their upper end of their price range, go in there or something of that nature. The essential issue really is just that, you know, we face the reality of having to go and get funding and financing and get this thing built, and our numbers just don't work if we artificially put three of the units without making any modifications to them, which we really don't have the ability to make significant modifications. We are very locked in terms of what we can build on that site, you know, to put those units in. We remain open to ideas, and we remain open to, you know, suggestion. But essentially, in bringing this to market, we do have to deal with, you know, the same financing and, you know, building markets that everybody else does.
Right. So the bigger houses don't get you closer to that?
Not much. I mean, you know,
well, it's offset by the smaller ones.
The economic reality of building in Carrboro is this, that the most efficient production builder that you can possibly get, and Cimarron Homes is it, okay? And they're the only ones that can do a green certified product like they do. Their cost for building a house like ours is up over $100 a square foot. It's like $106 a square foot, okay? And the dirt, after you go through this 2 or 3 year approval process that you have to go through in the town of Carrboro, where you have to meet unbelievably stringent stormwater regulations and whatnot, and after you pay for the dirt, I don't care what dirt it is, whether it was a trailer park or whatever, you're looking at an absolute rock bottom price for your cost of a house with no green features whatsoever in this town is at least $200,000. Okay, that's what it costs you for a little 1,350 square foot house that has none of the amenities that we're talking about. So it's just not possible to build. It's going to cost, a doghouse costs you $125,000 in the town of Carver. You can't build. So why is it that we think that a developer should have to bring $120,000 houses to market and sell them at a $130,000 loss per unit when he's doing everything he can to bring the houses in at the lowest possible price, at the longest term cost-effective way, which is green. That's what we're doing. So we're doing the absolute most cost-effective thing that we can do. And furthermore, we have voluntarily submitted ourselves to an excruciating, expensive, long process to do this when the ordinance allowed us to redevelop the site without going through any of this, only because we care about making it as affordable as we can and as green as we can. That's driving our every decision.
And I will concede that I know that the normal kind of way it works is that the developer like comes in and tries to get as many big units and whatnot and as much as they can, you know, out of the town, and then the town, you know, asserts the requirements for this, that, and the other in order to get granted that. However, it really is the case that we are voluntarily trying to do a lot that, you know, that we aren't required to, and we're basically kind of throwing ourselves on the mercy, you know, of the board to say, okay, well, you know, there are, we can do this, 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 and this. We really can't do this and this, you know, and that's really just kind of the economic
Madam reality. Mayor,
yeah.
Do you think it's time to see if we have a, can get a sense of the board on this?
I do. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have an action that we need to take, but we certainly can make some recommendations for these folks.
Well, we need to decide if we agree with this proposal or not.
Well, yeah, but do we have to do it through a motion?
Not a vote on
right.
On these reviews. It's really to get us, for the applicant to get a sense
right.
of where the board is. That's what you all did 2 years ago. There was no
right.
vote.
Okay.
But if anyone has a specific recommendation, I thought, Sammy, you were kind of working towards that.
Well, I have a recommendation for us as a board to really use what, I mean, they've gone through a lot of thinking and a process and highlighted a lot of issues that we as a board should be tasked to figure out how to facilitate so that we don't run into this kind of issue again. And I don't know if it's even appropriate considering this property itself is so unique, but I really liked, for example, the way that y'all described, you know, implementing all these green futures, and over the long term these are cost savings for people who live in those homes. But it's problematic when the only people who can make those savings are the only ones that can afford it. And
right.
so like how do you get around that?
Right.
And that's
right.
that's
exactly
a
so.
Society-wide
right.
problem.
Right.
And
that's
exactly.
A great issue to
right.
to
talk
have
about
a work
for a
session
right.
or something
right.
on.
Right.
They do offer a green mortgage program that allows you to incorporate recurring savings through energy efficiency
yeah.
and renewable sources into your monthly income, essentially.
Well, we really appreciate you coming out and sharing
and
this with
wrangling
us.
Wrangling with us.
Trying to, you know, trying to work on this. But, you know, I do think it was important for you to hear
mm-hmm.
our continued concerns.
Mm-hmm.
So with that,
all right, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah, really. Thank you for your effort. We have
so we have an executive session.
Yes, we do.
And is the mayor returning?
We have a closed session, so we need to. Well, does that come out now or afterwards? Okay, so are there any other matters by the board or Mr. Manager? Or the attorney?
I'd like to tell the board that I will be late next week. I'm going to make an I hope to be here by 8.
I will look forward to seeing you there.
Okay. And do we
and
need
I
want to?
Can I mention one thing
sure.
before? I don't know if you all saw my email to the commissioners about the dental clinic that they want to close at Carmel. I just find that very, very disturbing. I mean, certainly more so than the issues that have come up with the library over the last few years, as troubling as those have been. But this is, as I said in the email, a basic public health thing, and it's really what's accessible to the majority of the population and so many of the people who are in need of those services. And I was at Dr. Seaton's office today, and I was talking to Stephanie. You all probably know Stephanie if you go there, hopefully not as well as I do. But anyway, and she was saying, you know, they have people who can afford dental care who come to their office, and particularly people from the Hispanic community, you know, who are walking up from wherever it is, and, you know, and who are really very limited in their mobility and that kind of thing. And these are people who are paying for dental care so much more, you know, people who are going to the health department clinic. So I just wanted to, I guess the county's deciding on that tonight, but I just wanted to raise that again, just to get it more into people's consciousness. And I really think that not just this board, but the citizens of Carrboro and Chapel Hill as well, you know, need to think about this dynamic where we have a county commission where the majority, 4 out of 7 at least, owe their election to this district. And yet so many of these decisions are made as if the county starts at the urban services boundary and leaves out the 60% of us who are in fact the majority of voters and taxpayers. So anyway.
Well, well said. I'm really glad you wrote that letter.
Randy, yeah, just for the benefit of those who may not know, what we're talking about is the county consolidating their 2 dental clinics into 1 and just having 1 in Hillsborough, closing the clinic in Carrboro.
Well, they're proposing. That's proposed.
Proposing. I'm sorry. It's been discussed. Right. Proposing. And, you know,
it's been recommended by the county manager.
Right. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, dental care is health care, really. So yes.
It's pretty fundamental.
Accessibility and
well, and Carrboro has 3 times the population in the same size area as Hillsborough. So
I've got another
challenge. Yeah, go ahead, Sam.
I just wanted to thank staff and Steve for, with such short notice, accommodating the transition folks and their 10-10-10 event. It's really great that Carrboro will be able to participate in an event that's put on, it's going to be put on globally, to basically show that people are taking on initiatives to deal with climate change and that they're waiting. If they could do it, then people who have more power have no excuse to not be doing it. And then also, I just wanted to give a heads up to the board on and thank Carolyn for the research done on the secure communities information on how to opt out and look forward to maybe bringing a resolution in the coming weeks to have us requesting the sheriff that he seek to opt out of secure communities program, and that we also ask our neighboring jurisdictions within Orange County to do the same.
All right, good work.
Thanks, Sammy.
All righty, so there's a request for a closed session.
Move we go into closed session for purpose of discussing personnel matters.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
You see Mark out there soon?